to their reputation, whether they are ultimately proved innocent or not. Another consequence of having too many lawyers and administrative personnel is the proliferation of red tape and regulations surrounding almost everything in our lives. Lawyers and administrators are not bad people, but they tend to regulate things because that's what they're trained to do. If you have too many lawyers, overregulation naturally follows. Over the years, I have had an opportunity to deal with many personnel issues at the hospital, in the corporate world, and in the nonprofit world. I have observed how difficult it is to get rid of someone who is not performing their job well because employers fear a lawsuit for unjust termination. You will have to look far and wide to find someone who is more patient and understanding than I am when it comes to giving people a chance to prove themselves. But incompetence and lack of ethical behavior clearly exist in our society, and when allowed to go unchecked, the morale of others is damaged, and the result is inefficiency, and in some cases, even a danger to others. Are there some common sense approaches to dealing with things such as unfortunate medical outcomes or job termination? Some will be quick to dismiss this question, saying that without protective regulations and threats of lawsuits, discrimination and bias by employers would reign supreme in the workplaces of America. This, of course, assumes that we have not matured at all from the days of segregation and Jim Crowism, which is a huge and probably inappropriate assumption. One must also bear in mind that media scrutiny and bad publicity are huge deterrents of abusive behavior today compared to decades ago. If we continue to sue and regulate for every possibility, however, soon the level of distrust and suspicion throughout our society will begin to provide a real challenge to healthy interpersonal relationships. I believe it is possible to change the atmosphere of antagonism to one that is friendly and oriented toward the resolution of problems if we can find a way to make litigation the last solution rather than the first. Who controls those who control us? A great deal of bureaucracy has been added to our government in order to control corruption. But what about corruption in the government? How do we control that? I am aware of numerous patriotic humanitarian Americans who have been severely abused by components of our justice system, including one of my closest friends. His parents immigrated to America from Italy and were extremely hardworking, salt-of-the-earth type people. During the race riots in the late 1960s, their pizza shop was actually protected by rioters when everything else was being looted or burned because of the respect with which they were held in the community. He was trained as an oral surgeon and had a thriving practice, but in 1992, he bought a building for $275,000, renovated it, and 6 months later, it was valued at $1 million. Realizing his talent for real estate development, he quickly became one of the most successful developers in his state and went on to complete successful projects in several other states. My friend has the most wonderful family with a loving and caring wife and extremely bright children, all of whom have stellar academic credentials and not the slightest hint of being spoiled rich kids. In fact, all of their children have been heavily involved in programs to assist poor families. Our families have vacationed together for years, including spending Christmas together. We have such similar values and principles that our bonding was natural. As his real estate business increased, the available time he had for practicing oral surgery decreased, and he sold his practice to a colleague. Unfortunately, that colleague was later accused of Medicare fraud, but he did not have deep pockets, so the investigating agents came after my friend, even though he no longer owned the practice. They meticulously examined 15 years of his practice records for evidence of fraud, and were only able to uncover two questionable bills amounting to a total of $180. My friend owns a spectacular home, a Manhattan penthouse, two Ferraris, and a European villa. However, given the fortune he amassed, he lives modestly compared to the lifestyle he could have had if he so desired. I believe the lead agent was either jealous of his success or incorrectly concluded that he had organized crime connections that produced his wealth. Even though they were unable to uncover any fraud in his record, he was told that they would take him to trial as a co-defendant with the buyer of the practice, and would convince jurors that he had knowledge or turned a blind eye to the other doctor's activity, and that eventually he would end up in federal prison if he did not plead guilty to a federal offense in connection with the $180 discrepancy. Not wanting to put his family through so much trauma, he accepted their deal and was sentenced to a one-year house arrest and a $300,000 fine. I am convinced that the judge in the case knew my friend was innocent, and at sentencing made a point of saying, "None of his net worth and success in real estate had any connection to this case," and that he was confused. The result of all of this is that an outstanding American citizen who did everything by the book, who is one of the most ethical people I know, and an extremely generous humanitarian, is now a felon who cannot vote. He is giving serious consideration to moving to another country. I know of other examples of severe government abuses, but I don't want to give the impression that I think government is bad for us. We must, however, find a way to control excessive and inappropriate government intrusion into the lives of innocent, law-abiding citizens who currently have little or no defense against a bully that is supposed to protect us. How reasonable are our freedoms? Recently, the United States Department of Justice decided to defend a Muslim teacher in Chicago who had less than 1 year of seniority and wanted to take off 3 weeks in the middle of the school term to participate in a religious activity. She was denied the time off, but decided to take it anyway, and consequently resigned. The lawsuit alleged that the school violated her right to freedom of religion. This is a complex case with many legal nuances, and I certainly believe that freedom of religion is one of the important founding principles of our nation. However, making reasonable accommodations for one's religious beliefs should be just that, reasonable. In this case, the religious requirement could have been satisfied at any time during one's life, which means the teacher could have worked long enough to accumulate adequate time off and could have arranged far in advance for adequate coverage of her absence during the school term. Again, this is simply applying common sense, which seems to be rapidly disappearing from our society. Far too often, instead of looking for reasoned, rational approaches to our problems, we play the race card or the religion card or some other card in an attempt to evoke an emotional response. Have we become a nation moved more by emotion than logic when it comes to our governance and legal judgments? In this case, by forcing the school system to accommodate this teacher's demand for special treatment to accommodate her religious beliefs, the Justice Department has created a slippery slope with no end to subsequent requests by others for special treatment. This is an important case, because not only do the rights of the teacher have to be considered, but if one wishes to be fair, the rights of the children being taught and the rights of the school who planned on having a teacher for the entire school year have to be considered. I understand the Attorney General's desire to make sure that the teacher's rights are not trampled, but if our government is to be successful, it cannot have a myopic view of cases with such profound ramifications. That same myopic view by our Justice Department resulted in the dismissal of two of the defendants in a voter intimidation case against the new Black Panther Party in Philadelphia. The case was widely publicized because the incident was captured on film and distributed on YouTube, showing them verbally abusing voters and brandishing weapons. Would the Justice Department recognize such activity as voter intimidation if the perpetrators wore white sheets and burned crosses? I have a feeling that we may find out the answer to that question sooner rather than later, if we continue to tolerate legal myopia, justified by emotionally based, politically correct prejudices. I am not accusing anyone of anything other than failing to look at the big picture when dealing with important legal matters. Some will say that I am advocating a conservative approach to the two cases we just discussed, but I would strongly disagree and would say that this is neither a conservative nor liberal view, but rather a practical and logical one. If we can just tone down the rhetoric and discuss things like rational human beings, applying justice equally and not based on some political philosophy, we will validate that phrase at the end of our Pledge of Allegiance, which advocates justice for all. Liberty for all and privacy for some. We could write an entire book on the concept of liberty for all found in our Pledge of Allegiance, but I will concentrate on one related problem that threatens to severely derail our entire system of government. We frequently hear the question, why do many of the brightest and most accomplished people in our society refuse to run for public office? The answer is simple. They do not enter political contest because they know that their lives will be scrutinized and privacy and consideration for their family will be non-existent. If some unsavory incident from the person's past is uncovered or even suspected in the case of someone that the biased media does not like, a feeding frenzy occurs. I do not believe this was the result our forefathers envisioned when they fought so hard to establish freedom of the press. Such freedom should be coupled with common decency and not serve as a license to be obnoxious and inconsiderate to fellow citizens one disagrees with politically. I do not believe that the press should be restricted, but it would be very helpful if our leaders would provide consistent commentary about the role of the press in politics. It is quite immature to favor the press that agrees with a leader's political philosophies and shun the press that is critical of a leader's positions. Everyone has made mistakes in the past that they would prefer to keep private. If criminal activity went unpunished or there was a character defect relevant to the public position being sought, full disclosure and discussion is warranted. But if, as in most cases, it is just a juicy tidbit, the media should resist the urge to exploit it and concentrate on issues relevant to the job. I personally would be skeptical of someone who had never made mistakes, because they would probably have difficulty identifying with the rest of us. I realize that I'm asking a lot of the media, who now have 24-hour news cycles and have to find a way to fill the time. There are numerous positive and uplifting stories about incredible people in this nation and throughout the world that could easily fill the time and provide inspiration. By the same token, it is totally irresponsible for the media to ignore glaring warning signs from a candidate's past just because they agree with his political philosophy. We should certainly not be surprised, however, when our children are mean and unfair to one another if we continue to provide them with such examples of hostility toward those with whom we disagree. Showing kindness to the poor. When it comes to liberty and justice for all, the Bible makes it clear that we have a responsibility to be kind to the poor among us. As the famous old proverb, most likely Chinese, points out, it is better to teach a poor man how to fish than to give him a fish. America did not become a great nation by encouraging people to feel sorry for themselves and seek handouts from others. If we really want to eradicate poverty, we should allow significant resources and personnel toward providing education and opportunity for the poor. And if we are to provide assistance to our able-bodied citizens, it should be attached to a requirement for work or acquisition of education and/or skills. Not only will this improve self-esteem, it will prepare those individuals to participate in an increasingly sophisticated workforce. Work projects could also contribute to the maintenance of our national infrastructure and beautification if the right kinds of jobs are assigned as a requirement for benefits. If they have to work anyway, many people will put real effort into finding the kind of job they want as opposed to collecting unemployment benefits and being assigned to work they consider undesirable. Some conservatives would say that we should leave such people on their own to sink or swim because we cannot afford to keep supporting them, while some liberals would say that these people already have enough problems and that it would be unfair to require anything of them that would add to their stress. I reject both of those positions, and simply say the application of logic, once again, will prove most helpful in the long run to our fellow citizens experiencing financial misfortune. In fairness to all, every citizen of the United States should be expected to contribute to its welfare, which requires a fair system of taxation. We currently do not have such a system, because our tax code is so complex that those with good tax attorneys or accountants can find numerous loopholes to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. For instance, one well-known celebrity owns a very expensive mansion on a large piece of property in the Northeast, but pays very little in the way of property taxes because he raises honeybees on the property, which provides a little-known but gigantic tax benefit. I could go on for hours with similar examples, but the point is that given our country's financial crisis, the creation of a new and fairer tax system is urgently needed. The cries of tax the rich in the face of such a hypocritical tax code is frankly quite laughable. I do not believe that the rich are unpatriotic because they take advantage of loopholes, but I think we as a nation are smart enough to come up with a system of taxation that eliminates the need for slick accountants and lawyers and that allows everyone to contribute proportionately to the financial health of the nation, just as God designed for us in the concept of the tithe. Although I have pointed out many problems that we currently face as a nation, I have also made it clear that the principles upon which our government was founded are solid. In order to take advantage of the ingenious document known as the United States Constitution, we need outstanding, nonpartisan leadership with a vision that can unite the various political factions into a positive driving force, inspiring us and creating an atmosphere in which liberty and justice do flourish, allowing all to succeed. Chapter 13. What's good about America? It is a testimony to all that is good about America and the opportunities available here that a friend of mine was able to start out as a short order cook in a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant, and from there, through hard work and carefully observing the values that lead to success, establish his own national chain of fast food restaurants. As with any good rags to riches story, however, his life wasn't always easy. Born to an unwed mother he never knew, he was adopted after 6 weeks. His adoptive mother died when he was 5, and his father went in search of work around the country. From his family, My friend learned the value of hard work and perseverance. And in his early 30s, this young entrepreneur was given the opportunity to use his restaurant experience to take over 4 Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants in need of help in Columbus, Ohio. He was able to completely turn around those restaurants, and 4 years later, he sold them back to KFC, making approximately $1.5 million. That was just the beginning of his success, as he went on to found his own national fast food chain. Only in America, he was once quoted as saying, would a guy like me, from humble beginnings and without a high school diploma, become successful. America gave me a chance to live the life I want and work to make my dreams come true. We should never take our freedoms for granted, and we should seize every opportunity presented to us. His name, of course, is Dave Thomas, the founder of Wendy's, and my wife and I were among his first house guests after he built his dream home in Fort Lauderdale prior to suffering a heart attack in 1996 and his death in 2002 from liver cancer. The effect that he has had on America has been overwhelmingly positive. Adopted himself, he went on to found the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. He claims his decision to drop out of high school was his biggest regret, and so not only did he go on to get his GED at around age 60, he started the Dave Thomas Education Center to help other adults complete their GED. Dave Thomas's success is not rare in our country because of the freedoms we enjoy, and like him and so many others, I am incredibly thankful to call America home. I have been privileged to travel the world and visit all of its major societies. But to be born in a land of opportunity for anyone willing to work hard is an unfathomable blessing that should never be taken for granted. As I learned growing up, even with all the economic turmoil that surrounds us today, entrepreneurial opportunities still exist for anyone who is willing to work hard and think innovatively. The more stories I read about the success of people who applied themselves to make their lives better, the more motivated I am to be one of them. Knowledge really is power. And when I became a voracious reader, my confidence and grades improved accordingly. I needed little in the way of pep talks by adults, and today, it is my strong belief that if you can just get children to believe in themselves and understand that when they achieve academically, they are the ultimate beneficiaries, they will do what is necessary to become a successful contributor rather than a drain on society. God has opened many doors of opportunity throughout my lifetime. But I believe the greatest of those doors was allowing me to be born in the United States of America. Steady as she goes in a sea of worldwide trouble. Growing up, I heard many complaints from those around me about poverty. But visiting such places as India, Egypt, and Africa has provided me with perspective on what poverty really is. Hundreds of millions, if not billions of people in the world, live on less than $2 a day. Many of those living in poverty in this country, in fact, would be considered quite wealthy by poor people in other countries. Also, here in the U.S., there is no caste system to determine one's social status. So there are many opportunities for people to escape poverty without resorting to a life of crime. You are much more likely to be judged in this nation by your knowledge and the way you express yourself than you are by your pedigree. I'm not sure we realize how good we have it on this point. As I mentioned earlier in the book, racial identity has become significantly less important in many segments of American society today, which is quite astonishing, considering how strong racism was when I was a child. Considering the fact that prejudice is born out of ignorance, I feel very optimistic about the future of race relations and diversity in America, something that in many countries around the world is worsening. This land was originally occupied by Native Americans, who were largely destroyed by European diseases to which they had no immunity. Hispanic populations then became the majority, followed by people of European ancestry. If you throw in the effects of slavery, East Indian and Asian immigration, and our lack of southern border controls today, you have a formula for perhaps the greatest human diversity on earth right here in the United States. That diversity, however, is a strength, because every group brings its own particular sets of strengths to the table, and all have made very substantial contributions to the growth and development of our country. It is essential that we recognize these differences as the blessings they are. When you look around the world, particularly at the Middle East right now, violent political turmoil is everywhere. Regime change in other parts of the world is often accompanied by bloodshed and severe upheaval. In 2008, our country experienced a radical political change of direction without firing a single bullet or taking a single prisoner. The ability to make such monumental changes without civil war is a mighty testament not only to our founders, but also to our current political leaders in all parties. If in the future, our political leaders begin advocating violence to get their way, we should abandon them in droves and do everything possible to diminish their influence. Our system of representative government allows the people to periodically dismiss those elected officials who no longer represent their views. It is perhaps the most important civic duty of every citizen to inform themselves about the issues of the day and cast educated votes for people who truly represent their views. One should never vote for someone simply because they recognize their name or because of party designation. It is better to vote for no one at all than to cast an arbitrary vote. If all citizens take this duty seriously, there will be far less chance of our lifestyle and that of our children being hijacked by smooth-talking politicians. Freedom to mind our own business. Have you ever thought about how fortunate we are to have the right to privacy in such a technologically advanced society? Since 9/11, it has become increasingly important to monitor all suspicious activity in an attempt to prevent further terrorist attacks. One of the results of this monitoring has been the discovery of some unsavory habits and characteristics of many otherwise outstanding citizens. To its credit, our government has not disclosed those findings or prosecuted the involved individuals because we still respect the right of all of our citizens to privacy, as long as they are not infringing upon the rights of others. I realize that many holier-than-thou conservatives and even some liberals think we should use all gathered information about people they don't care for to discredit them. If and when this begins to happen, our country will become a nightmare akin to George Orwell's novel, 1984. We must jealously guard every American citizen's right to live as they please, again, as long as they are not interfering with the rights of other Americans to do the same. As a Bible-believing Christian, you might imagine that I would not be a proponent of gay marriage. I believe God loves homosexuals as much as he loves everyone, but if we can redefine marriage as between two men or two women, or any other way based on social pressures, as opposed to between a man and a woman, we will continue to redefine it in any way that we wish, which is a slippery slope with a disastrous ending, as witnessed in the dramatic fall of the Roman Empire. I don't believe this to be a political view, but rather a logical and reasoned view with long-term benefits to family structure and the propagation of humankind. When children grow up in an environment with loving parents who provide security, they are free to be happy and playful and eager to learn. God obviously knew what he was doing when he ordained the traditional family, and we should not denigrate it in order to uplift some alternative. However, I have no problem whatsoever with allowing gay people to live as they please, as long as they don't try to impose their lifestyle on everyone else. Marriage is a very sacred institution and should not be degraded by allowing every other type of relationship to be made equivalent to it. If gays or non-gays wish to have some type of legal binding relationship that helps with the adjudication of property rights and other legal matters, I certainly have no problem with that. But to equate that with marriage is going further than necessary. Likewise, I have no problem with Muslims or other religious groups who want to practice their religion in their homes, which may be vastly different from traditional Judeo-Christian religion, as long as they don't try to impose that on others or violate our laws. I could go on with other examples for quite some time, but I hope I have conveyed the wonderful freedom we enjoy as citizens of a government that protects the right to privacy. I was recently watching a National Geographic special about baboons, and one of the things that shocked me was the fact that dominant female baboons who lose their babies often forcibly abduct the babies of subordinate females. Unfortunately, in many societies around the world, the strong prey upon the weak like this. I am not naive enough to believe that the same thing would not happen in our country if our police and military, backed by a moral government, were not available at a moment's notice to stop such barbarous activity. We take for granted our ability to accumulate material goods and have them protected by the government, but this is by no means a universal right. I have lived the vast majority of my life in the state of Maryland, but it is a wonderful feeling to know that I can move to Texas next week, or Alaska, or Hawaii, or any place else I decide to live. Not only can I choose in which state I want to reside, but I don't have to learn a new language or new customs. There are many parts of the world where chronic unemployment is the rule rather than the exception, and if I am unemployed and a new factory with thousands of job openings is announced in Idaho, I can quickly move there to take advantage of that opportunity. This means that if my priority is having a job rather than enjoying a location, I can almost always have a job. In my lifetime, I have held numerous jobs, from high school and college laboratory assistant to bank teller, to mailroom clerk, to assembly line worker, to radiology technician, to encyclopedia salesman, to student policeman, to Hollywood extra. Through all of these jobs, I have acquired knowledge and different skills, which are all very helpful to me today. In many societies, a person is pigeonholed into a single track and basically has to spend their entire life working in that particular area. Here in the United States, however, we can go anywhere we want, take any job offered to us, and pursue the occupation of our choosing. I also feel blessed to live in a country where I can openly choose and express my faith without fear of persecution. There are several places in the world today where conversion to Christianity will result in persecution or even execution. It is very sad that civilization has not advanced in some parts of the world to the point of being able to tolerate different ideas. In this country, we must guard against a tendency to require monolithic thought as imposed by political correctness. This is an insidious evil that robs people of their God-given desire to think for themselves. It is tyrannical and cruel, not even sparing young children in school. We must never forget that our nation was founded by people trying to escape religious intolerance and tyranny. Whenever we see these monsters raising their heads, we should quickly slay them again. Our nation's cup runs over. When disasters occur in other countries, who is first on the scene with massive aid? The United States, of course. It does not matter whether the mishap befalls a friend or an enemy. We are always there. It doesn't matter whether it's a very poor country, such as Haiti, or a very rich country, such as Japan. We are still always there. Our compassion for and aid to other countries is unprecedented in the history of the world. Our compassion extends not only to food and material help during natural disasters, but during the recent Libyan civil war, we joined a multinational effort to prevent mass slaughter of the insurgents. Whether we can continue to be so generous in face of massive budgetary deficits remains to be seen. But we can certainly take pride in the historical humanitarian efforts of our nation. When I was 8 years old, I told my mother I wanted to be a doctor. "Benny," she said, "you can be anything in this world you want to be." Although it was an arduous road, filled with obstacles and grueling hours, I was able to realize my dream because of the generous freedoms we enjoy here in our nation. It is this ability of anyone to achieve their dreams that is perhaps the greatest thing about America. There are few places in the world where people enjoy the level of freedom we have in America. Here, you don't have to ask anyone's permission to start a new career or move to a new location. You are free to associate with whomever you please, and you are free to speak your mind if you decide not to allow yourself to be constrained by political correctness. If you have a fabulous idea, you are free to put as much time and effort into it as you like. And if that idea results in a financial windfall, you are entitled to spend your money to your heart's desire, after you have paid your taxes, of course. You can worship however you choose, without fear of persecution. Even the poorest people in our society live like kings compared to billions of desperately poor people throughout the world. Why do we enjoy all of these and many more blessings? It is largely because we have a representative government that respects the rights of its citizens and protects the life and property of its citizens, and because we have a military powerful enough to defend us against intruders. It is because we have a free market economy that, when unfettered, acts as an economic engine more powerful than any the world has ever seen. More importantly, we have a nation of faith so bold that we are willing to proclaim, "In God we trust," on every coin in our pockets and every bill in our wallets. We have enjoyed the blessings of the Almighty from the time when He aided a fledgling group of militiamen in defeating the most powerful empire on earth, up until the present, as He protects us from unimaginable terrorist threats. There never has been, and probably never will be again, another place like America the Beautiful. Chapter 14. What do we believe, and in whom do we trust? A successful young businessman loved to buy exotic gifts for his mother on Mother's Day. But he was running out of ideas one year when he encountered some amazing birds with the ability to dance, sing, and talk. He was so happy that he purchased two of them and couldn't wait to ship them off to his mother. On Mother's Day, he called her excitedly and asked, "Mother, what did you think of those birds?" "Mmm," she answered. "They were good." "Mother, you didn't eat those birds," he said, unable to contain his shock. "Those birds cost $5,000 apiece. They could dance, they could sing, and they could talk." "Well," she calmly replied, "then they should have said something." This funny story points out how important it is for us to speak up when confronted with danger. If we see our freedoms eroding around us and are afraid to stand up for what we value, we too will ultimately end up in the stew like those birds. Most Germans did not agree with Hitler's insane agenda, but their collective silence permitted an unimaginable human tragedy that stained world history known as the Holocaust. How might their nation's history and our world's history have played out differently if those who saw what was happening had taken a stand for what they believed? When rights and freedoms are not exercised, they become meaningless. If America is to remain the land of the free and home of the brave, we must have the courage to say what we mean unequivocally. If we allow our speech to be stifled by the PC police, we will be unable to have honest conversations in the struggle to resolve political differences. The founders of this nation were well aware of what happens when free speech is stifled. Of all the wonderful freedoms that characterize life here in America, freedom of speech is one of the most important. This was most dramatically demonstrated in a recent Supreme Court decision, which upheld the rights of members of the Westboro Baptist Church to display extremely offensive signs and shout obscenities during funeral services for veterans. They are an intolerant hate group that despises homosexuality and are angry with the military because gays are allowed to serve. There is almost no one who agrees with the Westboro Church. But because of the Supreme Court's decision to strictly interpret the Constitution, the rights of the church members could not be denied. Can you imagine how quickly this group would be executed in many other countries for doing such a thing? But ironically, the very military they are criticizing provides them with the freedom to be so obnoxious. I actually have some doubts about that legal decision, because the signs, obscenity, and noise infringe upon the rights of other Americans to assemble peacefully for the burial of one of their loved ones. If my right to free speech causes you actual harm, it becomes time to curtail my speech. Obviously, the preferable option would be for me to care enough about you not to hurt you by exercising my rights. But interestingly, as a society, we go to great lengths to protect the legal rights of fringe elements while at the same time imposing massive social restrictions on speech through political correctness. The real question is, will we, as Americans, accustomed to freedom, continue to sheepishly submit to the purveyors of political correctness without recognizing its erosive effects on our freedom? What each one of us says and does, and what our actions are collectively as a nation, is born out of what we believe. But if we never act on our beliefs, can we say that we truly value them? Can we say that we truly believe? And if we do believe enough to act, what is it that we as a nation feel passionately enough to sacrifice for? In other words, what is it that we stand for? True colors, our flag. A symbol points to a reality beyond itself. A wedding ring, representing the circle of unending, unconditional love between a husband and wife, for example. Or the Christian cross, turning the ancient Roman instrument of humiliation and torture into a symbol for the abundant life found through the sacrificial death of Christ. Symbolism abounds when it comes to our United States government, but I'd like to look at three important ones, beginning with our flag. Few things give me greater joy than watching color guards marching into an assembly with our country's distinctive flag held high. Everyone knows that there are 13 stripes to represent the original 13 colonies, and 50 stars, each representing one of the 50 states. But what you may not know is that red represents hardness and valor, white represents purity and innocence, and blue represents perseverance, vigilance, and justice. One of the largest American flags ever constructed was at the behest of General Armistead during the War of 1812. The British Royal Navy had launched a fierce bombardment on Baltimore's Fort McHenry, and they clearly had the upper hand. Their capture of Baltimore, which seemed imminent, would solidify a series of victories that had included massive destruction in Washington, D.C., including the White House. The commander of the British fleet had sent word to the Americans at Fort McHenry that he did not want to utterly destroy them, and that he would cease bombing them as soon as they lowered the American flag in surrender. Francis Scott Key was an amateur poet on a mission aided by President James Madison to try to rescue some captives being held by the British. Key was being held on one of the British ships engaged in the battle, since he had heard some of the war strategy and the British did not want him to tip off the Americans. His heart was broken as he heard the British missiles streaming through the air, destroying one of the last American bastions of safety. There was so much smoke and debris from the fighting that he was unable to determine whether the flag was still flying until early the next day, when by the dawn's early light, he witnessed the most beautiful sight he had ever seen. The torn and tattered stars and stripes of our flag, still proudly waving. Many historians feel that America's ability to repel that fierce attack was the turning point in the War of 1812, which eventually led to our triumph. Every time I see our magnificent stars and stripes, I think of the fortitude of those Americans at Fort McHenry, who, although outnumbered and outgunned, never allowed that flag to lower in surrender. That should remind us of who we are, a people who never surrender, who never give up, who are historically rooted in a faith in God rather than in the vicissitudes of man, who believe in freedom, and who would rather die than abandon our beliefs in equality and justice for everyone. Flying high, the eagle. Another of our proud symbols is the bald eagle. Some wanted a turkey as our national emblem, while others favored the golden eagle. But after much deliberation, the bald eagle was chosen because it symbolizes strength, courage, and freedom. In the 5,000-year leap, W. Cleon Skuzin writes that the founders had many other symbolic reasons for choosing the eagle. But the reason that impressed me most is that in order for the eagle to fly straight, its two wings must be balanced. If either the left wing or the right wing is too heavy, the bird will veer off to one side and crash. The liberals represent the left wing, and the conservatives represent the right wing. The liberals tend to have lots of great ideas that cost a great deal of money, and, if left unchecked, would quickly bankrupt the nation. The conservatives simply want to maintain the status quo and are not very adventurous. And if our nation were left solely to their ideas, stagnation would occur. However, when you balance the right and left wings evenly, the eagle is able to fly high and straight, and the potential for progress is tremendous. Of course, this is an oversimplification, and currently, the conservative wing is putting forth some fairly bold ideas about how to maintain the fiscal responsibility of a nation. But ultimately, that means they are trying to conserve the American dream for future generations. As a nation, we need to understand that there are valid functions for people of all political persuasions. No party has a monopoly on truth and justice. What is called for is mutual respect and a willingness to make decisions based on facts and empirical data rather than philosophical tenets. If we can remember these things, then the majestic nature symbolized by the bald eagle will be a rightful representation of our wise nation. Our Statue of Liberty, watching over those yearning to breathe free. When I was in high school, I determined to learn as much as I possibly could about everything. When I began studying European art and classical music, however, I received a significant amount of criticism from classmates. Some told me that those areas were not culturally relevant to me as an African American. But if the United States of America is the diverse conglomeration of people from all kinds of cultural and ethnic backgrounds, what does the term culturally relevant mean to its citizens? To answer that question, take a trip to Ellis Island or the Statue of Liberty, which have become widely recognized symbols of freedom and opportunity throughout the world. Walk through the museum, where pictures of immigrants from every part of the world are displayed on the walls. Look at the determination in their eyes, many of whom brought to this country only what they could carry in their hands. These people were willing to work not just 8 hours a day, but 12, 16, or even 20 hours a day. They worked not 5 days a week, but 6 or 7 days to make their way in the new world. At that time, there was no such thing as a minimum wage, but they didn't care. They were not working for themselves, but rather to provide an opportunity for their sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters, to prosper in this new land. It is the hard work of all those people from all those places that is culturally relevant to every American. Long before the Statue of Liberty landed in America, however, other immigrants came here in the bottom of slave ships, who worked even harder, for no wages. But they too had a dream that one day their great-grandsons and great-granddaughters might pursue freedom and prosperity in this land. Of all the nations in the world, the United States of America was the only one big enough and great enough to allow all those people from all those backgrounds to fulfill their dreams. It required the dreams and talents of all those people to create the quilt that is America. Every single one of us is culturally relevant to every other one of us. And that is why we are called the United States of America. Is the rapid rise of the United States really all that amazing considering the unprecedented freedom its citizens had? When citizens and indeed entire communities recognized that they would be the primary beneficiaries of their own hard work, there was no stopping them. It's like giving someone access to a vault full of money with two different scenarios. In the first instance, they are told that they can have the vast majority of the money that they are able to carry out over the next 10 hours. In the second instance, they are told to work on behalf of the overseer who will make sure that they are treated fairly. Which scenario do you think will generate the greatest intensity of work? That's a no-brainer, of course, and until recent decades, it was a no-brainer that hard work and innovation here could vastly improve your personal circumstances and those of your family. This belief was and should continue to be a basic part of the American dream. If you truly believe this, you should resist any attempts to establish the government as your overseer rather than your facilitator. It was no accident that this philosophy accelerated the rise of America. If we abandon it, even by accident because we are sleeping, our fall will be just as rapid as was our rise. In whom do we trust? Traditionally, America has been a God-fearing nation. Evidence of that can be found in our mottos, in many of our songs, in many of our national documents, and carved into many monuments and buildings. It has traditionally distinguished us from many other nations of the world, and it is one of the reasons we are always first in line when it comes to humanitarian aid for others. It is also why we have not used our great might to conquer other nations of the world. We pay attention to the issues of morality and ethics because our nation was founded on principles revealed to us in the Bible by a righteous and just God. Have you ever stopped to think about what money represents? It represents wealth and power. As we have recently seen, when you lack money and incur great debt, your influence and power decrease. Considering what your money says about you, it is really quite amazing that our nation has chosen to inscribe the phrase, "In God we trust," on all of our money. By doing so, we proclaim to the world that godly principles are essential to our way of life, that we trust not in our money, not in the power that comes from having money, but in our God. Having declared that for the world to see, it is essential that we allow our lives to speak as loudly as our money. We have been favored by God because we have acknowledged Him, but as the forces of political correctness attempt to push God out of our lives, we must have courage to resist them. That does not mean that we should retaliate or manifest the same intolerance they have shown. It does mean, however, that we must stand up and be counted. If they do not wish to accept the godly principles that we choose to live by, we should make no attempt to force them. But by no stretch of the imagination should we allow them to force their beliefs on us. For the God in whom we place our trust has entrusted each one of us with the freedom to choose our beliefs, as well as the mind to speak up for what we believe to be right. Compromise, opinion, and principles. The word compromise was referred to frequently during the debate in early 2011 about the national budget and again that summer in the debate about raising the debt ceiling. In general, compromise is good when dealing with issues about which there are legitimate differences of opinion. A problem arises, however, with the compromise of principles. For example, if one believes that killing is wrong in all instances, be it executing a mass murderer or aborting an unborn fetus, it will be very difficult to negotiate a compromise on the issues of capital punishment or abortion. If, on the other hand, an individual is opposed to capital punishment simply because of the great expense involved in each case, and only opposed to late-term abortion, that person would be quite capable of yielding to compromise. As a nation, we need to spend more time understanding who we are and what those principles are that define us. Once we identify them, there should be no apology and no compromise in applying them. However, on less vital issues, it is important to recognize that we are all in the same boat and will reach our destination much faster if we row the boat together. Our elected leaders need to spend much more time understanding the values and principles that made us into a great nation, and much less time worrying about what their party platform has on its agenda. More importantly, the people who select the leaders must recognize that they ultimately are responsible for what is happening in the country. If they don't like it, they need to select different leaders. Each citizen should put at least as much effort into selecting their representatives as they do into buying a new car. I live in a small town in rural Maryland, and I must say it is a very pleasant place to live. People still speak to those they don't know and are still willing to help someone in need. There was a time in America when people made a much greater effort to be neighborly. Now it is common for people to not even know their neighbors. People walk by others in their workplace who have been there for years and don't even acknowledge their presence. News commentators, political pundits, and public officials verbally savage those with whom they disagree and demonize their motives. This is all very sad to me because it seems that as time goes on, we should be becoming more civilized rather than less so. There is absolutely no moral justification for adults to spend valuable time disparaging their political opponents rather than delving into logical solutions for the problems that face us all. They, of course, justify it by their need to be reelected. How can we blame children for bullying and trash talk when we provide them with such excellent examples of how to go about doing it? I remember how much fun people in my high school had when they made fun of others. The people with the sharpest tongues were accorded the most honor and respect. It was only after I learned how to be verbally abusive to others that I was accepted as one of the guys in high school. But we were immature kids with poor judgment and lack of compassion. Responsible adults can do much better, even though the temptation is always there to demonize those with whom we disagree. During the Civil Rights Movement, the media played a tremendous role in changing public perceptions and attitudes with regard to race. If they choose to do so, they could once again play an important role in rectifying the mean-spiritedness that threatens to destroy the harmony and progress of the world's most powerful nation. However, many people make a great deal of money by polarizing people and cultivating a following. It takes very strong character to resist the urge to denigrate others and create a wise and all-knowing persona for themselves. I suspect that many in the media are pretty entrenched in their way of doing things and are not going to suddenly play fair. I should also point out that some in the media are real patriots and use humor, sarcasm, hyperbole, and satire in an attempt to awaken people to the realities of the times in which we live. Ultimately, the people still have the power, and just as they can rid themselves of undesirable politicians, they can vote with their money and remote controls, which will always have a powerful impact on the direction our media takes. The difference between tolerance and accommodation. Because of all the conflicting views necessitating compromise in our nation, the difference between tolerance and accommodation is an important one to understand. Principles of fairness and brotherhood should make us tolerant of everyone. We really do not have the right to impose our values and lifestyle on people who have a different point of view. For example, several years ago, a fourth-year general surgery resident at a hospital in the Midwest tried to enlist my help because she was being fired for praying with patients before surgery. I asked her if the patients requested prayer, and she said no, but she went on to state that they did not refuse to pray with her. I told her that she was abusing her position of power and that she needed to recognize her error and apologize to everyone involved. It is an abuse of power to make people pray, just as it is an abuse of power to keep people from praying. Our founding fathers understood this and wisely instituted a policy of separation of church and state, which is totally different from the concept of separation of God and state. I am happy that people with lifestyles with which I strongly disagree are free to live their lives as they please, as long as their lifestyle does not infringe upon my way of life. Some people, for example, believe in nudity as a way of life. I have no problem with them pursuing that belief in a nudist colony or some other place where young children would not accidentally be exposed to something they were not prepared for. This is tolerance. Accommodation might mean arming all the nudists with whistles, which they would be required to blow every time they rounded a corner in my community so that those not wishing to see them could turn their back or shelter their children. This is, of course, an extreme example, but it clearly shows the difference between tolerance and accommodation. As God-fearing people, we should absolutely exercise tolerance, but changing our way of life to accommodate everyone is not only impractical, it is also very unfair to the existing culture. Again, in order to be fair, we must have a firm grasp of who we are as a people and what is important to us. If we don't, the forces of political correctness will gradually blur the lines between tolerance and acceptance to the point that we will soon have no idea who we are or what we stand for. This process has already begun in our nation, and we must recognize it in order to stop it in its tracks. An example of how political correctness tries to usurp power and impose rules occurred a few years ago when some lawyers approached my wife and me to inform us that our Think Big banners could no longer be displayed in public schools. The letter T is for talent, which everyone has to some degree. The letter H is for honesty. I is for insight. N is for nice. K is for knowledge. B is for books. I is for in-depth learning. And G is for God. Because the G stands for God, they felt that was clearly a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. We informed them that the First Amendment prohibits government suppression of religious expression, and a rather vigorous argument ensued. I told them that we could resolve this at the level of the Supreme Court, which may have seemed like a bold and reckless statement. It really wasn't, because I knew that I was going to the Supreme Court the very next week to receive the Jefferson Award, and I figured I would ask Justice Sandra Day O'Connor while I was there. I did, and she said they had no idea what they were talking about, and that, of course, you could put such a banner in a public school without violating any part of the Constitution. The audacity of some of the secularists who try to get God out of everything with no legitimate legal backing is astonishing, and they must be challenged and their objections defeated if our value system is to survive. Being logical, not political. By now you might have gotten the idea that I don't like people who practice political correctness. But that would not be true. Many such people think they are doing what is right and necessary to cultivate a civil society. I do, however, believe they are misguided. Instead of advocating for unanimity of speech and thought, they should be emphasizing learning to respect and be gracious to those with whom they disagree. Think about how boring the world would be if everybody agreed with everything you believed. As I love to say, if two people believe the same thing about everything, one of them isn't necessary. Many recent polls have shown that most Americans believe that we are on the wrong path as a nation. They are discouraged about our future and the future of our children. I say be not discouraged, for God is on our side if we really trust in Him, as is indicated on every coin in your pocket and every bill in your wallet. We must stop being political and start being logical. The human brain has gigantic frontal lobes when compared with the brains of all other species. Why do we have these enlarged cerebral areas? The frontal lobes are where rational thought processing takes place, and it is there that information from the past and the present can be processed and integrated into a plan for the future. Unlike most animals, because we are so equipped, we do not have to simply react to our environment. We have the ability to plan and strategize, which allows us a great deal of control over our course in the future. Building on our solid foundation. I feel blessed to have lived here in America for 60 years, with hopefully many more to come. In all those years, I have never met a perfect person. And since nations are simply collections of imperfect people, I have never seen a perfect nation. And looking back through the history of the world, however, I feel very comfortable in saying that there has never been another nation like the United States of America. Yes, we have made mistakes, but we continue to learn from them, and as long as we remain capable of embracing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as our goal, and we are willing to guarantee those things to our citizens, I believe we will continue to grow in greatness. When our forefathers knelt and prayed for wisdom at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, then stood up and together assembled a short, truly unique and powerful document known as the Constitution of the United States of America, they were clearly guided by the hand of God. Today, the forces of political correctness would expel God from every public sphere in American life, and the hearts and minds of every man, woman, and child in America are up for grabs in this cataclysmic battle between the lovers of men and the lovers of God. Some would rather never choose between the two, but life is full of choices, and our individual and collective choices determine the quality of our existence. I believe it is time for us to stand up and be counted. We can no longer be passive because the Judeo-Christian way of life in America is at stake. We need not be ashamed of our faith, and we certainly should not allow those who believe differently to change who we are in order to be politically correct. Yes, we should accept them with brotherly love as we have been taught, but we should never compromise our belief system. We do believe in God, and we do believe in the right of everyone to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We do believe in an orderly government that facilitates these goals rather than impedes them. It is time to set aside political correctness and replace it with the bold values and principles that founded our nation and caused it to race to the pinnacle of the world faster than any other nation in history. It is time to stop apologizing and to start leading, because the world is desperately in need of fair and ethical leadership. If that leader is not America, then who will it be, and where will they lead? If we apply logic to solving our problems and add the godly principles of loving our fellow man, caring about our neighbors, and developing our God-given talents to the utmost so we become valuable to those around us, allowing these values and principles to govern our lives, then not only will we remain a pinnacle nation, we will truly be one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It is my prayer, America, that God will continue to shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. I pray that with his blessings, our past will be but a stepping stone to a bright future, and that our best days will truly lie ahead of us, a beautiful new beginning.
You've been listening to the audio production of America the Beautiful. Text copyright 2015 by Benjamin Carson and Candy Carson. Production copyright 2015 by Zondervan. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Zondervan, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at zondervan.com. America the Beautiful was recorded at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.